You're being seated. I hope that you'll locate within your bulletin the sermon notes or sermon outline that's provided for you there. For many folks, this really fits their learning style. They learn better by being able to take notes along the way. And if you're a note taker, I hope this is helpful to you. But I really want to encourage everyone, regardless if you're a note taker or not, to keep this out in front of you because it has the text listed there. And I think it will help us all as we move through the text kind of verse by verse this morning. And consider this text from Mark chapter 4 that we've already had dramatically presented to us during the children's time this morning. Jesus has had a very busy day of ministry, preaching, and teaching. And in verse 35 we begin. That day when evening came, he said to his disciples, "Let us go over to the other side," leaving the crowd behind. They took him along just as he was in the boat. There were also other boats with him. As we look at this verse, this passage of Scripture this morning, I think there's some important concepts that are there for us, and I think there's some life application principles which we can apply to our life and take with us. But this first key concept that I want us to look at for just a few moments as we begin this text is this key concept, number one, that we can't ever forget, and that is that Jesus was human and Jesus was divine. Jesus was both human and divine. And where I think we see this in his text is that why wouldn't he want to live? He was worn out. It was the end of the day. Let us go over to the other side. You sort of get the idea that it's the end of a day, a long day. And Jesus is saying to his disciples, you know, I'm tired. It's time to get out of here. And if you watch the text and read very closely and carefully, I think you can see some other indication of this. Leaving the crowd behind, they took him along just as he was in the boat. You get the idea that Jesus is almost walking in front of them and they take him along in the boat. He's already in the boat. It's the end of the day and he is tired. Now, why is this an important concept for us to understand? There has been within the church always this tendency to remove any hint of humanness from Jesus. Within the church, within the Christian movement, we sometimes struggle with this balance of the human and divine. It's one of the mysteries that has been carved out through the patriarchs and matriarchs, and one of the things that we attest to in our faith, that we recognize this. Yet it's difficult for us. And I sent out an email this week talking about the Da Vinci Code. And I think that the heart, if you really kind of peel the onion, at the heart of the controversy around the Da Vinci Code has to do with this uneasiness around the human and divine aspects. And the Da Vinci Code has lifted up some human parts of Jesus' life, or revealed some, whether they existed or not, that makes some folks very, very uncomfortable. And, you know, I don't want to preach a sermon on the Da Vinci Code as such. You know, people, when this controversy came out around the book and around the movie, people said, well, are you going to preach on the Da Vinci Code? And some people were saying, are you going to preach against the Da Vinci Code? And I really kind of struggle with that on a number of levels. And I want to say a couple of things of why. First of all, it is a work of fiction. We can't forget that. It is a work of fiction. In the book, Dan Brown attests to some things, this is what makes it a struggle, that are true, and he attests some things that he says are true that really aren't true, or that they've been disproven or discredited over the years. But he asserts them as truth. So as we read this, some things that are presented as fact are in fact just fiction. Now, that's the nature of fiction. It always has been. I could lift up other works of fiction that we don't go all, you know, crazy about. But the fact that it did touch on a nerve somewhere along the line, I think, speaks to us. The other thing I want to say about it, and that is this, is that it is an incredibly, incredibly popular thing, the Da Vinci Code. To kind of show how popular it is, I went to the grocery store this week and I saw a magazine that on the front it says, "The Da Vinci Code Diet." Now, I'm telling you, If there is the Da Vinci Code diet, we realize we're looking at something that is enmeshed in pop culture. I am all about pop culture. If you know me at all, I use examples from movies and television shows. I talk about pop culture all the time. I think the church has sometimes does a disservice to pop culture. We'll look at what we call high culture and say, that's fine, incredible. We'll look at folk culture and say, you know, that's okay too. But we look at pop culture and poo-poo it and push it away. And the pop culture is where a lot of us live. But we also have to be very careful because it can be very superficial. It can be very trendy. It can be a passing whim. Let me just remind you, 6 years ago, do you remember all the hullabaloo around Y2K and all that stuff? And the churches got all bent out of shape and preaching all these seminars on Y2K. And I could point back over the years at other things that the churches has just gotten so excited about and so outraged about, which really turned out to be something that was really just kind of a passing trend. Now, I got a newsletter that a preacher had written that this was the biggest attack on the church in his 30 years of ministry. And I just, it's not the biggest attack on the church in my 20 years of ministry. It is something that is raised a lot of curiosity, and it's certainly something that's been very popular, but it's something that I think that we need to be careful that we just don't go way out on a limb on some stands that the church should take. But maybe instead, take a careful look at why it has resonated with certain parts of our culture. I sent out an email this week that had an article by Brian McLaren in it. I don't know if you had a chance to read it. But Brian said, what I really believe, that part of what it really boils down to is sort of this concept of the human and divine. And maybe the church has in some ways sort of wrapped Jesus up into a package that has taken all of his humanness out in such a way that is not attractive to people or does not resonate with people. When instead we need to also look that Jesus was a human. We've always recognized, it has always been heresy to say that Jesus was, not human. The church has always struggled with that. The old creeds, as they were, it was a carved out, the Apostles' Creed that we say, talks about, he was born of Pontius Pilate, the Virgin Mary. All of that placed him as a time in history to understand that this was a historical person, a real person who was a human. The Nicene Creed even goes further with it. Nicene Creed goes, God from God, light from light, true God from true God. He came down from heaven, was incarnate in the Holy Spirit and the Virgin Mary, and became truly human. Jesus was human. Jesus was also divine. And this text, as well as any other text I think in the Bible that you can find, sees both aspects of Jesus. Here we find him at the end of the day. He is worn out. He is tired. It is the end of the day. And he says to the disciples, let's go to the other side. And he actually sort of heads on down the hill, and they say, well, I guess it's over. And they follow him, and they all get in the boat, and they take off on this this journey across if just one other thing about the Da Vinci Code, if you're looking for some things of what was accurate and what was not accurate and what's been embellished and that sort of things, there is so much material available. I don't think that I need to share it with you. I think you can go to your Christian bookstore, you can go on the internet, you can find an abundance of things. I saw a Dateline special talking about what was accurate in the book and what's not accurate. I just want to caution us as being the kind of church that gets all puffed up about some little straw army to blow over that actually just ends up being something real trendy. Throughout my ministry, some of the straw armies that have sort of been put out there was playing rock and roll music backwards to reveal hidden satanic messages. Do you remember that? There's all this stuff about Harry Potter. I mean, it seems like every year something else comes up. Let's just be careful. Let me caution you about that. Look at why it is resonating with people. And as the church, let's reveal the truth. Let's point to the real truth. Let's not get caught up in blowing over some straw army, okay? Enough said about that. Move on to verse 37 and 38. A furious squall came up, and the waves broke over the boat so that it was nearly swamped. Jesus was in the stern, sleeping on a cushion. The disciples woke him and said to him, "Teacher, don't you care if we drown?" There's kind of a legendary story that's told in my family And I actually don't remember it, even though I was a part of it. I was just a baby at the time. But our family was one of the early Lake Lanier families. We had a lot out there that we'd go and camp and cook out at, and there's a boat dock down there, and we all learned how to ski. And my dad, we're a family of six, and so my dad, in order to accommodate this, made a homemade pontoon boat. And the way he did it was he took some old, big old oil, empty oil drums, and he somehow hooked them all together, and then he built like a little floor on top of it with some little walls around it, and he got a little trolling motor, like a little fishing boat motor, the one that you have to sit in the back and sort of steer that way. And we could kind of putter around as a whole family, you know, put lawn chairs out there. You know, I mean, this was, you know, in their defense, a lot of has been come out about safety since then. I think about this term, it sounds like my parents were so irresponsible, but people did things like that. You know, that's back in the day and age where, you know, when you went on a long trip, you put your kid back up in the back window to take a nap, you know. I mean, that was that time in that era. And we would troll around on this little, you know, this pontoon boat, sometimes get out a mile or two from the dock. And Lake Lanier, if you've ever done any boating out there, you realize that, like the Sea of Galilee, storms can come in a moment. And one afternoon they were out there and a storm came up. And my dad, you know, it's one of these stories that about every Thanksgiving or Christmas, we're sitting around telling stories, this gets told. And you can see the look of terror in his face and his voice as he tells that this was truly the most frightened he ever was for his family's safety. And the fact that he had kind of created this thing, he feels so guilty about it year after year about what could have happened. You know, I was a child sitting on my mother's lap. He had two 10-year-olds and one 7-year-old, and they're all out in the boat and the storm blows up. But it was a scary thing. Squalls are scary things. And so you can understand the terror of the disciples in this story. The squall was blowing in, but you can only imagine the waves crashing in on the boat. They're fearing for their lives. Archaeologists tell us that the boats this day and age are about 28 feet long. It's not a real big boat. And a big storm has come up. But there's another part of the story that we can't forget. There are at least four professional fishermen in this group, right? We know that. So this wasn't new to them. They had seen these storms. They had seen these squalls. They'd been out on the boat before. So it comes to my key concept number two. And that is this. That in a crisis, we often rely on our own experience to bail us out. We'll say more about that. But that's my second point. Key concept number two. In a crisis, we often rely on our own expertise to bail us out. Now, why do I think that? Well, first of all, you get the idea of what the disciples do. They immediately start bailing water. They go to their expertise, what they know. They've been out there, they've seen storms, they know how to get out of it. They're pulling themselves up by the bootstraps and they're bailing water for all it's worth. And then they realize they got one extra set of hands that aren't working. And, you know, they say, Jesus, who's asleep, and we'll talk some more about that in a second. They say, they don't say, Lord, don't you care if we drown. They say, teacher. I don't know. Maybe that is an indication that there are, that, you know, teacher was a title that you would say to somebody that you were affectionate to, that you recognized and had respect for. But in other parts of the gospel, we see them refer to him as Lord. Here they say, teacher, don't you care if we drown? Oftentimes, when we get into a hard time and crises are going to come in our life, we immediately go to what we know. We put our initiative force, our wisdom, the successes of our past, our tradition. We pull all that together and we frantically start bailing water. I've seen that in personal lives. I've experienced my own personal life. I've seen it in the life of the church. You know, when some little obstacle comes up and you're in a meeting and people get panicked and start bailing water, and what can we do? Let's look back to the past. What did we do that worked before? And people get all in a fury and a concerns and this bailing water, and what's going to happen here? We're going to drown. Oh, what's going to happen? So in those crisis moments, we tend to lie on our own experience. And then watch this key concept number three. When our own expertise fail, what do? We blame God. They say teacher, not Lord, because, I think, they wanted to solve it their way. We get into a crisis, start frantically bailing water, and wonder why God doesn't choose to rescue us using our plans. Why aren't you using our plans to rescue us, God? We put a plan forth. We got scrambling around and we did exactly what we did 2 years ago and it didn't work this time. And why, Lord, why did you not bail us out in the way that you always have? Where are you, God? Don't you care about us? When our own expertise fail, we blame God. We wonder where God is. We wonder why God is not working our plans our way. In verse 39 continues, he got up, rebuked the wind, and said to the waves, "Quiet, be still." Then the wind died down, and it was completely calm. There was a man who lived back in 1858. His name was John Solomon Rary. 12 years old, he had an unusual gift, and that is that he was able to take the most unbreakable force, the most disturbed animal, and was able to go in and in just a few moments almost, but certainly within a few hours, was able to calm and to break those horses and to train them. A movie came out, a book about it called The Horse Whisperer. It's interesting. I was looking this week, and there's also a show out now called The Dog Whisperer. I started Googling things and just putting something whisperer. I put The Fish Whisperer. There was a fish whisperer. I put The Reptile Whisperer. There was a reptile whisperer. But the original thing was The Horse Whisperer and this story, because you see back then, and listen to this, because I think this is important for us, even in the context of our story this morning. The assumption was that the only way to break an animal that was out of control was violence and extreme force. That was the only way to break a horse. And what this man learned and knew was there was another way. There was a calm way, this whispering way. Oftentimes when trouble comes to our way, and trouble's going to come, storms are going to come, when that happens, we have this adage, don't just sit there, do something, panic, bail water. When in actuality, what we need to do is don't just do something, sit there. And as Dennis sang for us earlier, Dennis and Gail, beautiful song, "Peace, Be Still." If you come into my office, you'll see a sign that's been made there by one of my staff members to remind me, "Be still and know that I am God." In those moments of crisis where we tend to rely on our expertise and do it our way, maybe rather than doing something, we just need to be still and recognize Christ's peaceful presence within us. The fact that Jesus was able to sleep in that boat, that small little boat, is an indication of his great trust. In fact, there's Old Testament examples of how someone was able to sleep in a storm. And that was an example, an illustration of great trust and great faith. And here we see it lived out with Jesus. That leads us to our fourth key concept, is that during those times of trouble and struggle and storm, we often fail to see Jesus is right in the boat with us. Where are you, Lord? He's in the boat. His peaceful presence is right there with you. It's never left. It's always been there. And there's a second part, though. We need to be able to recognize Jesus for who Jesus is. That he is able to calm the seas around us. Not only do we recognize his presence, but we also recognize his ability to take our problems and our struggles and our trials and to make them be at peace. Verse 40 and 41, he said to his disciples, "Why are you so afraid? Do you still have no faith?" Earlier in the day, he had taken them aside and he had broken down one of the stories, one of the parables. He told them and he explained it to them and told them about the kingdom of God. He's investing his life in it and they still don't get it. He says, why are you so afraid? You still have no faith. They were terrified and asked each other, who is this? Even the wind and the waves obey him. Brings us to two questions that I think we should reflect and respond. And I encourage you, as you hear these questions, to not immediately rush to an answer in your mind. I think this is something that we have to meditate upon almost continually, almost in every circumstance of life that comes its way, but particularly in those difficult circumstances. We need to be reflecting and responding to these two questions. The first one is this, is the question that the disciples ask. Who is this? We need to ask ourselves, who is Jesus? Who is Jesus really? Above all else that we need to work on as followers of Jesus Christ is the ability to see Him, to really see Him as He is in life's circumstances. Not to see Him through the lens of some little, you know, taking all the human stuff out and really kind of prettifying Jesus up in maybe some ways in which the church historically has presented Jesus. Maybe not going to the other extreme, the Da Vinci Code and The Last Temptation of Christ and some of the other books that have come out in recent years that have sort of harped more on the human side of Jesus. Maybe not in our own understanding of preconceived notions about who Jesus has been or who Jesus has been for us. But to really to look Him and to see Him as He is. Maybe it'll be one of those aha moments. Maybe this is a bad way of explaining it. But have you ever sat with someone that you thought you really knew and you heard them and saw them and realized that they've changed and they're different and maybe they're not the way that you had always pictured them or assumed them? I see that in my children all the time. I was with my daughter this week and we're eating a meal together and you know she just graduated as a junior and I'm looking at her through my lens of, you know, looking at her as like a 7-year-old, and I realize that she is a 17-year-old, beautiful, mature, intelligent woman. Now, I know that's, you know, kind of an extreme example, but I think sometimes we look through Jesus with these lens. Maybe we're looking at Him as we did as a 12-year-old child, or we're looking at Him through the lens that someone else has given us, and we're not looking at Him and seeing Him in the circumstance and the context as He really is, especially when we get in these circumstances of life that cause us to panic. Who is Jesus really? Who is He for you? And then this final question, and Jenna lifted it up as well in our children's time. Even the wind and the waves obey Him. Will we obey Him? Will we obey Jesus? And once again, let's don't be so quick to answer, because I know we all got the church answer and our hands go up immediately. But to truly follow Jesus, to truly obey Jesus, means making some radical changes many times. It means leaving behind some things that maybe we don't want to leave behind, that we'd rather more try to retrofit into our life of faith so that it would still work. But maybe that's something we've got to push aside. Old notions of the way things are. Be able to look at through eyes that see creation anew. Who is Jesus? Will you obey? It's the Word of God for the people of God.